There's a big difference between being a critic and being an opponent. This is the essence of their argument. The Israel lobby is the most powerful foreign lobby in Washington. At its center is AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which they point out is not a public affairs committee. There is a legal term called a PAC. They use the term, but they are not a PAC. And they also point out that the lobby has many members, including Christian Zionists, and probably the most famous one is Reverend John Hagee. Some of you might have heard of him, and their support for Israel's government is driven by a Christian fundamentalist religious theology. They consider that the Israel lobby is the most effective lobby in Washington, D.C. for the following reasons. The lobby carefully follows all legislation and media reports concerning Israel. And we can assume that they like to make a video documentation of all public events related to Israel, like these gentlemen over here who don't give their names. They take the Israeli government's lead on issues. They are generally aligned with Israel's right-wing Likud party, not the Labor Party or Meretz. The Labor Party would be something like the Democrats. Meretz would be something like maybe Dennis Kucinich. It would be like the left liberals of the Democratic Party. And they're saying the AIPAC and the Christian Zionists are aligned with the right-wing parties in Israel, kind of Israel's neocons. They also argue that AIPAC is expert in playing what's called the game within the Beltway, that they successfully craft legislation, media treatment, and diplomacy on behalf of the Israeli government, and that they heavily contribute to political campaigns, especially to oppose anyone running for public office who has a chance of getting elected, like Cynthia McKinney, if you know her, who are critical of Israel. They also contend that the Israel lobby's success also comes to the detriment of the United States and the Israeli government interests. And I use the word government rather than the country itself, because I think, as I mentioned, these are very important differentiations to make. They argue that the Israel lobby's influence over U.S. policy has hurt the national interest of the United States, but you have to really go through this book with a fine-tooth comb to finally find out what they mean by the national interest of the United States. They say that strong U.S. support for Israel, especially for the settlements in the occupied territories, has fueled anti-U.S. terrorism and has resulted in low esteem for the United States in the Middle East, including among Arab allies of the United States. And they also argue that the settlements hurt Israel itself in both the policies and the practices. But we should also realize that Walton Mearsheimer and the Israel lobby and the neocons who they're often set in opposition to actually have a number of areas of agreement. They would agree that Israel has a right to exist, and that any credible threat to Israel's existence should be responded to by direct U.S. military intervention. They would both agree, both schools, that the U.S. has vital strategic interests in the Middle East, and based on the Carter Doctrine, which was essentially developed by one of the senior realist foreign policy experts, Zbigniew Brzezinski, that these vital interests are the Persian Gulf's oil and gas. And they also would agree that the United States should maintain a large network of military bases to protect these vital U.S. interests, and that the U.S. should, and I use the word realistically in quotation marks because they're called foreign policy realists, that the U.S. should be prepared to use its military force when necessary to secure the gas and oil. That's what they mean by this obscure term, national interest. Some of the critics of Walton Mearsheimer argue that they are anti-Semites and that they have recycled a famous Tsarist forgery called the Protocols of the Elders of Zion that argues that there's somehow a secret Jewish cabal that controls the world. Gersheimer have totally demolished any claims that they're anti-Semitic, although we know that some people who have supported the book are anti-Semitic, but they themselves are not, nor is nearly everyone who has their position, including many people in Israel, anti-Semitic. These critics, of course, of their work have written many articles about them, and some of their publications, some of their public presentations, rather, such as this Public Affairs Council in Chicago, have actually blocked Walton Mearsheimer from speaking in public. They have received little criticism from the political left, people like the group I'm in, LA Jews for Peace, and from those who argue that their actual agenda, the agenda of Walton Mearsheimer, is to boost the U.S. imperial presence in the Middle East, or at least to hold the line, and that at a time when U.S. policy, especially in Iraq, is in total collapse, and that Israel, in the view of Walton Mearsheimer, is getting in the way. And on the website of our organization, we've collected a number of these articles, some like by Steve Zunis from Foreign Policy and Focus. And our website is www.lajewsforpeace.org, and you can find a whole collection of essays that are critical of Walton Mearsheimer's thesis, but a critique from the left, not the typical one that is usually heard, a critique from the right. And the critics, the critics from the left would make 5 points. Maybe they make others, but I'll try to summarize them in 5 points. The two authors have long academic careers as realist foreign policy expert at the major elite universities, Chicago and University of Chicago and Harvard. They've made many presentations before the premier foreign policy think tank, the Council on Foreign Relations, and other such bodies. In fact, I think they're both members of the Council on Foreign Relations. And their previous writings, which have not been on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, they've mostly, following the leadership of Brzezinski, have been there to help develop strategies for the U.S. to maintain its predominant position. That's the term that Brzezinski uses, rather than hegemonic, they use the word predominant. If you look at their work, you'll see they use this term national interest all the time, which on careful examination, careful excavation, refers to the region's energy resources. And I think another point the critics make is that their work in the London Review of Books in 2006 and this book in 2007 only emerged after the United States met its debacle in Afghanistan and especially in Iraq. And there's several other things which are kind of unique to their presentation, which I think is one of their weaknesses. They forcefully argue that oil was not a factor in the invasion and occupation of Iraq. And they suggest that the Israel's lobby support for the war was a critical factor leading to the invasion. As I show you a series of maps, in fact, some of you might have seen it last time, because I've showed them in a previous talk about the elections. I think it's incontrovertibly true that the Iraq war is an oil war. And they also downplay the massive U.S. military footprint throughout the greater Middle East and the long history of U.S. support for repressive regimes in this area, such as Saudi Arabia, which was actually a topic in our previous joint venue several months ago in the winter. But let's compare their claim that it has nothing to do with oil compared to where the oil is and see if it has any credibility. This looks at the proven oil reserves of the world in 2003. It's not too different. I mean, this is the Middle East, 726 billion barrels of reserve. I think that also includes the Caspian Sea area. The next is Europe and Eurasia, South and Central America, where we know that, like Mexico, Venezuela, and Colombia, they've already reached peak oil, the United States, peak oil. Africa, of course, which is where the new, another major area of U.S. Military